This is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio. Hello, I'm Larry Mueller, here along with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And if you wonder why animals do some of the amazing things they do, you should call us right now. Our number is 1-800-462-7413. That's 1-800-462-7413. Among the calls this hour, we'll also explore this special topic. And what is it this time, Patricia?
Well, you know, there's some new studies that suggest that prairie dogs have a vocabulary all their own. And it turns out that their vocabulary is very complex. And a little bit later, we're going to talk about what they're using these vocalizations for.
That'll be interesting. And we'll also welcome an author and former school teacher who's written a how-to guide for introducing kids to dogs and introducing dogs to kids. And we'll learn more about that in a bit. But first, let's take some calls. Here's the number again, 1-800-462-7413. And here's our first caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi there, this is Eric from Virginia.
Eric from Virginia. Where in Virginia?
Fairfax.
Fairfax.
Right outside of D.C.
Right outside of D.C. Okay, well, what's on your mind today?
I have a question about our 3-year-old adopted cat. We adopted her when she was 1 year old, and since we've had her, she's never covered her waist in the litter box.
Mm.
And we wonder if that's something that can be taught or if it's just something that's never going to be programmed.
You know, it's not the easiest thing in the world to teach a cat. There do seem to be very strong individual differences. And we don't know, you know, I've never seen anybody do a PhD on burying behavior or not. But there seems to be great individual differences. And some of it may be just genetic predispositions, you know. Mm-hmm. We all tend to do things a little differently depending on how we're programmed.
Mm-hmm.
Some of it might be developmental, what she learned early on in life. So it's really hard to say exactly why some cats are so fastidious about burying their waist, and other cats, they just don't seem
Could
to mind
less.
At all. The answer of can you teach a cat to do this when she hasn't before basically depends on how much training you want to do. I think you probably could if the cat does any digging in the litter at all. So let me ask you that. Does the cat do any pawing or digging in the litter at all?
She doesn't paw in the litter. She paws against the side of the container and paws on basically everything else, but not the actual litter.
Oh. No. Is she, by any chance, was she declawed?
No, she's not.
The only reason I ask that is because every once in a while, a cat who undergoes the radical declawing, it's basically an amputation of the last joints of 4 digits of the front paws. Sometimes when they're recovering, they dig in the litter and it hurts them. And so then they try to avoid digging in the litter. But that was a theory, and it's wrong, as some theories often are. So that's not it. But what's interesting is she seems to like to paw against a different kind of a substrate. You might want to try a different kind of a litter. And you might want to try a lot less litter. Some cats don't like to dig in the litter because it's just too much. Yeah, it seems to be too much. It'll pause. They sort of sink in it. It's like sinking in quicksand.
Okay.
So you know what I would try? I would try, this may not work, but I would try a very thin layer of litter or possibly some other litter. And anytime you see her actually pawing an actual litter, train her that when you give a little click from a clicker, you can even use your voice, you know, just make a click with your mouth, then she gets a little tiny treat. So she's learned that a click means, ooh, I did something good that's going to lead to a treat. And then every time she paws in the litter, click and treat her. Only problem with that is with elimination, is I'm afraid she may get out of the box when she hasn't gone yet.
Oh, right, right.
So this could be an interesting training paradigm, but it could actually be a little tricky, too.
But
so,
look at it this way, Eric. The cat's 3 years old. Going to live at least another 15 years or
You've
so.
You've got a long time.
You got at least 10, 12 years.
What else do you have to do, right, Eric?
I guess we won't have children then.
Okay. Easy for Larry to say. Have Larry come and do it.
Thanks a lot for calling. 1-800-462-7413, the number to call. Patricia, a few weeks ago, we read a pet tip from Teresa in Green Bay, Wisconsin, who blew a few notes into a musical recorder. Remember that?
Yes, I do.
It was to startle her cats when they tried to wake her up in the morning. Well, we heard from Barbara in Washington, D.C., who wanted to respond to this pet tip with her own story.
Yeah.
So here's what she writes. Teresa's story reminded me of my wonderful orange cat, Mr. Schnurley, German for the one who purrs.
The one who purrs.
He loved the sound of the alto recorder so much that he loved it more than catnip. He would follow me around like the Pied Piper everywhere throughout the house, singing along with the recorder. And when I stopped playing, he would paw me and indicate any way he could, I want more, more, more of that sound. So I guess it goes to show that every cat is different, or as you say sometimes, Patricia, some cats don't read that chapter of the book.
What a great story.
Isn't that great?
I wish we had a recording of her using her recorder and the cat purring. I wonder if they harmonized at all.
Send us a recording of that recorder.
Yeah, would.
Maybe we'll play it on the air. Who knows?
Wouldn't that be fun?
That'd be fun.
It's
send
a great
it to
idea.
Us. And thanks a lot for that information and that response. And how do people respond to us?
We love to hear from you. Just send us an email to pets@wpr.org.
And, of course, you can call us, too, at 1-800-462-7413. And let's see who's next. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hello, this is Jan in Cabin John, Maryland.
Cabin John, Maryland. Well, Jan, it is a real pleasure to speak with you. And what can we do for you?
Oh, we have a woodpecker. And it may be more than one woodpecker, but he's pecking huge holes, small fist-sized holes, in our chimney. And we have tried, and the neighbors have tried, all kinds of things. We have Dryvit on the siding, which is that synthetic stucco. And he shouldn't like that. It's mostly plastic. But I noticed he's gone up one corner in a vertical line with his holes, among other holes, and that may have some bugs or something that attract him, but we don't know how to stop him. The neighbor throws tennis balls at him.
That
one man tried owls on his roof, and that, you know, they were impervious to that. Help.
Yeah, this is not an uncommon problem.
No, it isn't.
Oh.
No,
oh.
We have lots of beautiful trees and lots of birds.
Yeah, and you know, I'm going to turn this over to Dr. Mueller because I see his face is just radiating knowledge.
Well,
he's just dying to tell you what to do.
That's the guy I need.
Well, I wonder about the physical makeup of the chimney. Is there a little ledge kind of at the top of the chimney?
Yes. And sometimes he will peck on the metal cap, and it sounds like a lion roaring in the house.
Oh, he pecks on the metal cap, too. You're destroying what I was going to say, which actually what people can do is there's some netting that you can get at the hardware store or at your garden center, and it's very you can see right through it. I mean, it looks you wouldn't notice it. But you can, if there's a little ledge on the chimney, you can attach it on that ledge and hang it down, and then maybe attach it a little bit at the base with some tape or something.
All right.
And then the bird can't get at it.
Ah.
However, I don't know how you cover the metal part.
Uh-huh.
Well, you know, that you could, one, that could be about a reflection. That's just
a
hypothesis.
It could be a reflection.
But that's possible.
Yeah.
And also, you know, once woodpeckers start drilling holes in a particular area, I think part of what happens is they just sort of get into that habit, and they'll just try out any area. And particularly if it makes a good noise, you know, in spring, part of what woodpeckers are doing, they're not just looking for food, they're also drumming. So
yes,
one possibility is you could get some male that found this metal ridging and makes a great noise. It's like, I am the biggest, baddest male woodpecker that ever lived. I'm so cool. And all the females are like, wow, who just moved into this neighborhood, right? So that's also one possibility. So if you could cover that up so there was no sound, that would also possibly help the process.
Yeah.
All right.
So that's what you need to do, Jan. Give that a try. And if it doesn't work,
call us back and we'll say,
we'll come up with something else.
All right.
Thanks a
we
lot.
We will try it.
Thanks for calling.
Thank you.
1-800-462-7413, the number to call. Coming up next, we'll discover whether prairie dogs can talk, and if so, what the heck are they saying? I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and this is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Calling All Pets website offers you the opportunity to submit email questions, browse pet tips, and find out when Patricia will be in a city near you. Information online at callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org. Pet books and training guides are also available through the radio store at 800-747-7444.
Welcome back to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller here with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And Patricia, you have some news to share about prairie dogs and language.
That's right. There's some new research by Arizona University biologist Khan Slobodchikov who suggests that prairie dogs have different alarm calls for different types of predators.
Hmm.
So we all know prairie dogs, right?
Yeah.
Those are those cute little round rodents who live in extended social groups. And they are considered very cute by coyotes as well and other predators, hawks, snakes. They're prime prey for those animals. And their only protection from predation is to run underground into their burrows, but they have to do their feeding above ground where it's pretty dangerous.
So how do they protect one another then?
Well, they have this great system of watchdogs, of watch prairie dogs. The phrase is appropriate in this case, right? They have this great watchdog system, and they have individuals who act as sentries, and they keep a lookout for danger while the others are feeding. And when the sentry sees a potential for danger, he or she gives out an alarm bark. It's this short, sharp noise, and when the others hear it, they all dash into their burrows as fast as they can. And what Dr. Slobodchikov discovered is that if you analyze these barks carefully, it turns out that even though they sound the same to our ears, they differ depending on the predator. They have a different bark for humans, for coyotes, eagles, hawks, etc.
How in the heck did he figure this out in the first place?
Well, you know, he started by doing classic ethological research. He recorded animals over hundreds of hours, and he recorded what was happening, and so he cataloged their calls in relation to what elicited them, right?
Mm-hmm.
So great observational, classic kind of ethological work. But then he also did experimental work where he set up situations where he elicited calls by doing something that would look like a predator. So he showed them, for example, silhouettes of a skunk or a coyote. And we know that animals respond to silhouettes as if it was the real animal.
Sure.
And then he compared those calls with others given in response to different types of intruders. He even had trained dogs who were trained to walk directly towards the colony without actually hurting the animals, but nonetheless elicited alarm calls.
And how specific are these alarm calls?
Well, he thinks they're very precise. Slobodchikov thinks they're so precise that they vary even if a person approaching changes the color of his shirt.
Now.
Well, I have to tell you, some people are a bit skeptical about this, but his research suggests that these calls contain information that is so complicated that you would translate it as something like, a tall human in a gray shirt is approaching versus a short human in a yellow shirt.
Oh, man.
But, you know, most surprising to me is his observation that animals use a new bark, a different bark, for a new object or a new predator. He discovered this in a laboratory setting, and he showed them pictures of something they'd never seen before. He showed them a picture of just a black oval, you know, just a big black spot, right?
Yeah.
Never seen it before. And they all responded to it with a very similar bark, but it was a bark that the researchers had never heard. So very interesting information in the calls that these little animals give.
And speaking of calls.
I knew you'd come up with a good transition, Mueller.
We would like to take your call at 1-800-462-7413. And matter of fact, here's another caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Nina in Glen Arbor, Michigan.
Hi, Nina. Thanks for calling. What can we do for you?
Well, I have a German Shorthair Pointer male fixed who is around 3 years old. We rescued him about a year ago, so we don't know his early history. And our problem is riding in the car. We have a sedan, and I take him out for walks, and I have to drive him to the locations. And actually, no matter where we're going, because, of course, he doesn't know if we're going for a walk, he paces back and forth, he whines, he barks, He salivates. He makes it impossible to drive safely for any of us.
Oh,
and I'm usually in the car alone with him. So I have not figured out any way to calm him down. We haven't done a lot of long road trips, but even on one recently, he was quite out of control. So we finally sedated him for the return trip.
Right.
But we can't sedate him on his way to his walk.
No, no, you can't. The first thing I would suggest, maybe ask you, is have you tried a crate where he at least can't pace around?
Well, we haven't. You know, the sedan is doesn't give much room.
Right.
You know, and I thought about buying a new car, but, you know, buying a new car for the dog is a little even beyond us. But we've thought about it.
Well, I bought a farm for my border collie. You can buy a new car for your pointer.
Yeah. No, we've been through a lot of furniture in the years with dogs, so...
I know. I hear you loud and clear. And, you know, there is another solution to a crate, if a crate won't fit in your car, which is, and there's that dog now, is there are harnesses. They're like seatbelts for dogs.
Mm-hmm.
And they're much safer, by the way. First of all, you know, one of the biggest causes of death of dogs in accidents is not the accident itself, but often if there's a car accident, what happens is a door gets open and the dog gets out and gets hit by another car on the road. So if you have your dog in the car a lot, it might be safer to have your dog confined in some way anyway. And there's a harness you can put on your dog, and then you attach it to the seatbelt. That would keep him from pacing. And one of the things I've found with these dogs who get super excited is the more they pace, the more excited they get. It's a kind of a feedback loop.
Right. Now, somebody had suggested the crate with even a cover on it. Do you think that's necessary?
Might be a great idea. If you can get a crate in your sedan, and there are some, by the way, who have doors on the side, which makes it a lot easier depending on your car. Some crates work better in some cars with a door in the front and others with a door on the side. You might want to think about that a little bit. But if you do use a crate, one of the things that can help, if you cover it and the dogs aren't overstimulated by all this visual stimuli, and you know, if you think about the speed of things going by, some dogs seem truly overloaded by it.
Right.
So he might just be excited because I'm going to go to the park and I'm going to get my walk. And when I'm excited, I get really vocal and whiny. A lot of dogs are like that. So even in the crate, if he can't see anything, he still might be whiny, but at least he wouldn't be pacing around.
Is there some way that you recommend getting him accustomed to the crate in the vehicle? I mean, do we need to do it beforehand or just something in... The first time we introduced the crate, sort of how do we get him used to the idea of the crate?
And that's a great question. I'm glad you asked, because it's not true that because, quote, dogs are den animals, that you can just put them in a crate and shut the door and expect them to be happy. That's often exactly the opposite of what happens. So it's a very good question, and the quick answer is just very slowly. And what I mean by slowly is first you throw treats inside an open crate. Don't even shut the door. Just play the game. If you run in the crate, you'll get a treat.
And this is in your house, not in the car, right?
You know, you could do it either way.
Either way? Okay.
You could do it either way. If it's nice to have it. It's easier for you, frankly, to do it in the house.
Huh.
But so, yeah, that's one possibility. But, you know, they could also try it in the car if it was an easy in and out for the dog. And the dog liked to jump and was healthy. And so it sort of depends on the logistics in the dog. But if the dog loves to go on car rides, it might be okay to do it in the car. And then you toss a little piece of chicken. Dog jumps in the crate. And then you let him ride out. You never shut the door. And you do that 10 times in a row. So he's like, I like this game.
Mm-hmm.
So first you've taught him, I like to go into my crate. That's really step one. I like to go into my crate. So you want to separate going in to being in. Think of those as two separate things.
Right.
Yep. Good luck.
Great. Thank you very much.
You bet. Have fun.
Thank you very much for calling. Here's the number for you to call, 1-800-462-7413. Patricia, we recently discussed the topic of horses and colorblindness on the show. Remember that? Yeah. Turns out horses and dogs are both red-green colorblind. And we heard from Elsie in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. She asked this, what about cats? Does a black cat appear to another cat to be funny, kind of funny looking? I myself have three cats, and one of them is black. Two of my cats react differently to the black one. Is this his color, or is it his personality they don't like?
Oh, that's a really interesting question. My guess is his personality.
Yeah.
Certainly cats know that a black cat is black, in that cats are very good at seeing contrast. And so, as a matter of fact, one of the things we know about what we think of color is that, you know, there's hue. Is it blue or is it green? But there's also how much black or white in something, you know? What are the shades? What are the tones? How much contrast is there? So there's no question that the cats see an all-black cat, somewhat similar to as we do. But my guess is it's not about not about hair color. It's probably about personality.
And if someone has an email question, how do they send that in?
We love hearing from you. Just send us an email to pets@wpr.org.
And you can call us at 1-800-462-7413. And we have another caller online, so let's go there. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Greetings, Patricia and Larry. It's Mark from Anchorage, Alaska.
Mark, thanks a lot for calling from Anchorage. And what can we do for you?
Well, you know, I've got a wonderful Shetland sheepdog. She's about 9.5 years old, very, very intelligent, loving, a bit manipulative and spoiled. And she is, you know, like the rest of her breed, an alert barker.
Right.
And we have big windows here in the living room, and she likes to sit in a chair or walk around and look out. And she will alert bark, certainly for dogs, but, you know, for moose or people or whatnot. And over the years, I've used the, you know, one of her favorite treats and using the command look when she starts to go barking, and she will immediately cue to me, come to me,
good,
stop barking, take the treat. But then she will go and manufacture something happening. I can literally see the dog brain working. And she'll like sort of like be walking around, and then she'll walk over to the window and look for something and sort of pretend that it's there when there's absolutely nothing going on, nothing in the distance, no, nothing like that, just in order to get a treat. So
right.
I modified the look command for not only treats sometimes, but for praise, and wanted to see if that would help. That didn't do it because, you know, she would still work it to where at some point that she will get a treat when there actually is something that she's barking at.
Right.
And then I used the low command, enough, and that generally works, but she, no matter what, is trying to manipulate me in the situation to get some sort of goody out of the scenario.
Gotta love it. Gotta love it.
Yeah.
That's why when people say my dog is so smart, I say, I'm so sorry.
Either I'm a little slow, too, maybe. I don't know.
No. You know, it's what else do they have to do all day long but figure out how to train us to get what they want? I love it. But I would also do something about it, as you would obviously like to. And here's what I do, is I would use what's actually frustratingly called negative punishment, which is nothing like what it sounds like. Negative punishment, here's an example of it, is you're pretty sure, to the best of your knowledge, your dog has manufactured a reason to bark in order for you to say enough and her to get a treat. So she goes to the window, doesn't even really look at anything, barks and trots over to you looking for your treat. Here's what I'd do. I would have a treat handy, and I would hold it out to her and let her sniff it, and then I'd say, oh, I'm sorry, you don't get that. Because that was really stupid. You're not going to get that. Either that, or I would totally ignore it. I would just completely ignore it. The negative reinforcement or the negative punishment is called negative because you're taking something away, and it's punishment because you're trying to decrease the frequency of a behavior. The only problem with that method, satisfying though it might be, and it is really fun, by the way, is that might cause her to like bark more, like, well, I'll try doing a better job barking, you know, something like that.
So
as I'm talking, sort of thinking out loud, you know what I think I would do is, if she, quote, manufactures a bark as best you can tell, comes over and looks at you, I would fold my arms into a Jack Benny. I would fold my arms and just look up and away, basically saying, I got your number, girl.
don't make the eye contact to her or anything like that.
Yep.
She also knows when the mailman is coming. She knows when I order a pizza. It's pretty funny. So
well, I don't know why you haven't taught her to order pizza for you yet. This dog sounds smart enough.
You know what I'd call that? I'd call that positive negative punishment.
It's crazy making the terminology for the four quadrants of operant conditioning, from positive reinforcement to negative reinforcement to positive punishment. Positive punishment, by the way, is if you like hit your dog. That's example, quote, positive
That's
punishment.
That's not positive.
Well, it's because you're adding something and you're trying to, it's crazy making. I wish the people who came up with this terminology
had made it a little more intuitive.
I think we should use positive punishment on them.
Thanks, Mark.
Thank you very much for your time.
Appreciate it very much. If you'd like to join in, the number to call 1-800-462-7413. Coming up next, a how-to guide for kids meeting dogs and what goes into writing about animal care for children. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and you're listening to Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
The Calling All Pets website offers a variety of information, including online archives of the show, pet tips, Patricia's dog training books, and the opportunity to submit email questions. The website is callingallpets.org. Pet books and training guides are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444.
Welcome back to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And this week, we welcome Stephanie Kalmanson to the program. Stephanie is a former school teacher and now the author of several children's books. And her latest book is called May I Pet Your Dog? The How-To Guide for Kids Meeting Dogs and Dogs Meeting Kids. And she joins us today to talk about it. Stephanie, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. This is a great opportunity to be here.
Well, I'll tell you what. Maybe you could talk first about your book, May I Pet Your Dog? What kinds of lessons do children learn when they read it?
Well, the first thing that they learn is right on the cover. Always ask the owner, may I pet your dog? There are a lot more lessons in the book, but if children come away with that one concept, I will be happy. But I go from there, of course. Children learn how to approach a dog when the owner says yes. Holding out a hand with fingers down for the dog to sniff, because, of course, dogs learn about the world by their sense of smell. They'll also learn that not all dogs are the same. We introduce a Jack Russell Terrier who's wiggly and jumpy, and a big giant named Chester, who is a real angel of a dog. And there are some dogs who are not to be petted. When there is a dog who's not to be petted, children learn what to do. For example, Harry explains after a dog has growled, grrr. Harry explains, did you hear that growl? That means don't come near me. Don't even look at me. We'll turn away our eyes. We'll turn away our heads. We'll stay perfectly still and quiet until she passes.
And you know, you do a wonderful job of explaining it to us right now, but also in the book itself, the illustrations, the drawings are wonderful. Someone did a great job illustrating your book.
That is Jan Ormerod, and she sure did. She made a very clear decision to make uncluttered pictures and made the child and Harry and the other dogs the stars. When you look at this book, it's almost like seeing a video or something on the computer, because as you turn the pages, the art shows step by step what you do along with the text. So it's very simple, and she made a great decision. She also shows clearly the dog's body language, because while this book is for young children, and I don't go into great detail about body language, there is an awareness of that body language. So when a dog is friendly, we see a friendly posture. And when a dog is one to stay away from, we see a posture that expresses that feeling from the dog. The tail is out straight back or up, and the ears are up, the fur in the back of his neck is up. That dog's trying to look big. So through her pictures, she shows children what to look for.
You mentioned Harry again a little earlier. Tell us more about how your dog, Harry, inspired you to write this book.
Oh, he really, really did. My first dog, I should say, was Rosie, and she was the quintessential Buddha dog. nothing fazed her. And then I adopted Harry, who was quite different because there's no replacing Rosie as there is no replacing Harry. I adopted Harry after he spent 3 months of puppyhood in a cage. And when I brought him home, he didn't even walk well because he wasn't allowed out of the cage more than 15 minutes twice a day. And he was terrified of everything and everyone. And Patricia, thanks to you, in part, I worked with trainers and I went to classes. And your book, The Cautious Canine, was a godsend for us.
Well,
I
that's
should say.
Music
I
have to an author's ears.
Oh, my God. I really thank you, because you should see Harry now. We went to a gathering last week, and we hadn't seen the people in literally 2 years. And Harry was going around meeting and greeting, and people kept saying, is that the same dog?
Is that the same
dog? So Harry taught me, because that dogs have to be approached properly. I knew it, but I needed to write this book for the sake of him and other dogs. Because when children, he automatically loved children, which is very sweet, but when children were noisy and yelling or coming at him fast, he would just shrink down into nothing. You talk about body language, his tail would be tucked under, and he would be all scrunched up and seem to want to disappear. And I would try and explain to the children how best to approach him. And I was amazed. There has never been a book on this subject before for children. There's only been a page in adult books or some kids' books, but never a simple book to share this important lesson about meeting dogs. So Harry was definitely my inspiration, and he does beautifully now.
And, you know, a couple of the books you've written are told from the dog's perspective. Do you find it easier to write from the dog's point of view?
In this case, it just came naturally because I wanted to set a positive tone. Again, children and adults. I tell you, a grown-up who has three dogs read this book. She was going to give it to her granddaughter. And she said, you know, I didn't know that when a dog thumps its back paw really fast, that it means you found its favorite petting spot. I thought I was annoying the dog, and I always stopped. So it turns out the book's for adults and kids. But Harry is a dog who needed this book written, and I wanted him to talk to kids so it would set a positive and comfortable tone.
Well, that the book certainly fills a really important gap that's been out there, and it also raised a question with me, which is about the writing process itself. I know you've written several children's books. They're not all about animals, and I just wondered, what is it like to write for children as opposed to writing for adults? And does your approach change if you're writing nonfiction stories about animals, sort of from their perspective, or not?
Well, when I write nonfiction, the way I do it and the word that comes to mind is clarity. I hone it down to the essence of what I'm trying to accomplish. When I write, I've written many dozens of picture books, and the only nonfiction that I've written has been about dogs because they're so much part of my soul. But the difference is I can play with language more when I write Dinner at the Panda Palace or The Frog Principle. Mm-hmm. Then I run with the words and I just have a great time. But when I'm writing nonfiction, again, I try and keep it simple so the child isn't overwhelmed and comes away with the facts and the spirit that I'm trying to convey. I wanted Harry to talk to the kids because that makes them comfortable. And he tells kids at the end of the book, try to learn all you can about dogs. Ask your parents, teachers, or librarian to help you. Look, listen, read, and don't to forget to ask, may I pet your dog? Even Harry tries to keep it simple. It's funny. It's like my alter ego. I don't know it's me talking.
What topics do you plan to write about next?
I want to write more about Harry, actually, because changing a dog from a terribly frightened creature into a confident and happy dog. It's his nature. I shouldn't say I changed him. I should say guided with the help of you, Patricia, and wonderful trainers like Eve Demian and Mickey Niego in my own area. I'd like to write his story. And I always keep the kids in mind because it could be their story. So that's high on my list of next projects.
Stephanie, thank you very much for being with us today. I really appreciate it.
It's been such a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Stephanie Kalmanson is the author of May I Pet Your Dog? The How-To Guide for Kids Meeting Dogs and Dogs Meeting Kids. She joined us today from the studios of WNYC in New York City, New York. And if you'd like to join us with an animal behavior question, you can give us a call at 1-800-462-7413. And here's another caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
My name is Alicia, and I'm living in Birch Bay, Washington.
Alicia, thank you very much for calling. What's on your mind?
Oh, I'm glad that I have Patricia and you on the line. We have an 18-month-old female border collie. She's agility-trained and very intense. And in March, we adopted a baby brother, an Australian Shepherd puppy, with a tail and an attitude.
Okay.
The Border Collie was absolutely marvelous before he came along. She was a puppy. She played well. She was respectful of others and almost submissive when she met a dog that was older or where she showed a need to do that.
Okay.
When he arrived, she changed immediately. She became very serious and intense.
Aww.
She lost all of her puppy play. She became a total disciplinarian, even knowing rules that we didn't know she knew.
Oh, no.
And she became very possessive of my husband because I was spending too much time with the puppy.
Oh, dear.
And we want to know how we can bring our puppy back so that she's much more in balance again, so that she doesn't feel that she's in need of being the teacher.
And also having to defend herself from what sounds like a dog with an attitude.
Yeah. He has an attitude. I think if the tail wasn't there, maybe he'd be an Aussie instead of a Border Collie look-alike.
Right. Gotcha.
You may not like the answer to
this
question.
Yeah, Larry's reading my face quite accurately. Here's a suggestion. Just temporarily, as an experiment only, I would suggest finding a friend to take your Aussie puppy for 3 weeks. That's a long time, I know. I know it is. It's a long time. But here's what I want to see. Is she going to change back into who she was?
Mm-hmm.
Because there's a possibility that you're never going to get back who you had as long as you have this other dog in the house.
Mm-hmm.
But there's a possibility that who you had is gone.
Yeah.
Partly just because of age. You know, 18 months is a very important age.
Yeah.
And so I don't want to put it all on this little puppy Aussie's shoulders. It's very possible that part of what you're seeing is that she's just starting to grow up. And, she's not so much a puppy anymore. And dogs can get less playful and more serious. And we all know Border Collies can get intensely intense.
Mm-hmm.
So that's certainly not atypical.
Okay.
But it does sound as though this particular puppy seems to bring out an awful lot in her that is just so serious and clearly problematic for you guys. And it might be partly because it's just another dog, and it might be because he is who he is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that sort of is brings out a lot in her that you wouldn't necessarily have seen before. So my suggestion is to experiment. Don't do anything in permanent until you've experimented. Find a wonderful friend, bless them, who would take your Aussie for 3 weeks. And I say 3 weeks because it can take, it's going to take her some time. It probably really and realistically would take her 3 months to even longer to come back. But you would at least have a sense of how different is she, if he's not sort of always there.
Yeah.
And then if she does change in that third week while he's still gone, you and your husband can sit down and say, okay, do we want to deal with this by finding him another home? Can we even talk about that? But better to talk about it when he's not there, frankly. And if you decide, no, we can't do that. We love this puppy, and he's really important to us. We're going to try and deal with what we've got. Then I would call in a really great trainer, and a certified animal behaviorist, a great veterinary behavior, somebody who really understands social behavior in dogs, understands positive reinforcement and conditioning, and could help you manage the situation. I don't think you're ever going to fix it. This is not the kind of thing where sort of magically everything's going to go back to the way it was. But I think those are your two choices. But I think the best way to start is to sort of really see where you are by finding, by just putting him, just sending him to summer camp.
Yeah. they play well together most of the time. Right now they're out doing ball chase and he's herding her.
Yeah.
While she chases the ball, and then they run back together. So when they're playing together, they're playing beautifully. It's just that when he's doing something that she deems is wrong, then that changes. But if it were just him, I'd be okay. It's when it goes out to other dogs that I get concerned.
That's what we don't know, how much that's going to change if he's gone and how much is that age-related.
So take him off to summer camp.
Yeah, send him to summer camp and go from there. Yeah, good luck with that one.
Thank you for calling. 1-800-462-7413, the number to call. Stay tuned. Our animal trivia question of the week is next with your chance to win a copy of a children's book by Stephanie Kalmanson. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, and this is Calling All Pets from Wisconsin Public Radio.
If you missed an episode of Calling All Pets, the show is available online. Our website offers archives of the show, along with the opportunity to submit email questions, browse pet tips, and learn more about a guest you heard on the program. More information available online at callingallpets.org. That's callingallpets.org.
You're listening to Calling All Pets. I'm Larry Mueller, along with Public Radio's favorite zoologist, Patricia McConnell. And before we go back to the phones, it's time for our animal trivia question of the week. So if you think you know the answers to this week's question, give us a call at 1-800-462-7413. All correct guessers will have their names pooled together, and five winners will be selected at random to win a children's book written by Stephanie Kalmanson. And here's today's question. Black-tailed prairie dogs have a complex system of communication that involves a variety of verbal sounds and behavioral displays, and these include territorial calls and warning calls when a predator approaches. They also communicate through the sense of smell and touch. So when prairie dogs greet each other, what body parts do they touch together? If you think you know the answer, call us at 1-800-462-7413 and tune into the show next week to find out the correct answer. And now it's time for some more calls. Let's do that. Here's the number, 1-800-462-7413, and here's another caller. Hi, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, I'm Stephanie from Virginia Beach, and I have actually a couple questions regarding pet doors. I have two cats, and I'm trying to train them to use a window pet door. And I'd like to know just if you have any tips on training, also if it's likely that other cats will come into our home. And the last thing is that we'd like to try to train them to use the bathroom outside, and I didn't know if that would be something they'll do naturally or if they'll need coaxing.
Good questions. The answer to the first one in terms of training your cat to use a pet door is to make it really easy for them at first. And so basically you just want to take the flap and affix it so it's open. So just in some way make it so it's open so they get used to going in and out. And you might want to lure them outside or inside if that's what you're going to do. Obviously, I'm presuming it's safe outside. It's a very safe environment for them. So you're going to take little pieces of food or something and put it on the other side and just let them start getting comfortable going in and out. And then what you might want to do is for some cats who are bold, you can just let the flap down and just hold it partway open and get them used to pushing through it and the feel of it sort of running across their head and their back as they go through. Some cats are very sensitive about that, and you might want to use an interim kind of a flap that's lighter than the actual flap that comes with the door, something that's very soft, maybe some fabric that is opaque, and then they learn to push through, but it's very easy to push through, and then you graduate to the actual flap, because usually they're a little bit stiffer, especially if you live somewhere where there's a weather issue. You don't want a complete open hole, right? So that's how to get your cat started. However, this also relates to your second question, which is if something can go out, can something come in? And I
the
gotta
answer
tell
to that
you,
is yes.
Larry and I have gotten how many phone calls over the years of people who said there are squirrels, there are other cats, there are chipmunks, there are birds, there
raccoons.
Are raccoons.
Oh, my gosh.
So I don't have – I live in the country, and I have to tell you, I could really use a pet door. And I don't have one because I would have a menagerie in my living room in a microsecond. And within 3 days, I would have squirrels and raccoons and possums and other cats and who knows what would be inside my house. So think very carefully about whether you really want to do that. And then you had a third question, which has escaped my brain.
Actually, just about them using the bathroom outside.
Oh, yes.
If they'll do that naturally or if that's something we would need to work with them on as well.
What you might want to do is think of a place where you would like them to go and make it a little nicer. I wouldn't worry about training them, but I would think carefully about if we want our cats to go outside, where do we want them to go and where might we not want them to go.
Okay.
And where they're going to want to go is very loose, sandy-like soil that's somewhat like litter. So what you might want to do is figure out a place you do want them to go and dig it up, make it very soft, add some sand, and add some actual litter from litter box. Not even new litter, maybe litter that's been used a little bit that has a good scent on it. So that's a great cue. Oh, this is the outdoor facility. So just help them and make it really easy for them.
And back to the pet door for just a minute. Can't you put like a garage door opener on your pet's around your pet's neck or something?
You can. We've talked about that before. Good point, Larry. There is a device you can buy. You put a collar on your animal that you do want to be able to come in, and it's just like a garage door opener. So when the cat approaches the door rises up like your garage door, and the cat gets through, and then it goes down again.
Oh, wow.
So those are obviously more expensive, and they involve more training, and they involve your cat wearing a collar.
Okay.
It's a little larger than a normal one. But Larry's right. That is a possibility.
Something to think about.
Well, I definitely appreciate this. This is very helpful.
Thanks, Stephanie. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. 1-800-462-7413, the number to call. Patricia, Lynn from Memphis, Tennessee, called in a while ago to offer advice for anyone who's trying to train cats to go to the bathroom outside, as a matter of fact.
Speaking of.
Yeah, stay listening there, Stephanie. She said if you simply take a couple of bags of sand and put them in a spot where the cat likes to play, they'll be going to the bathroom in the sand in no time at all. Lynn says works like a charm.
Exactly. It's all about substrate to a cat. It's all about what it feels like and partly smells like. So if you want to add a little bit of litter to that sand as well, that can really help.
And if you want to send Patricia a pet tip.
Oh, we'd love to hear from you. Send us a tip to pets@wpr.org. I want to hear from the people who have sandboxes for their kids who have problems with cats going in their sandboxes. Because that's the flip side of this story is that they do like to go in sand.
And if you'd like to join in, here's the number to call, 1-800-462-7413. And here's another caller. Hello, you're on Calling All Pets.
Hi, this is Sangeeta from Milwaukee.
Sangeeta, thank you for calling. What can we do for you?
I got a cute little puppy from the Humane Society a couple weeks ago, and she's great. We love her, but she has a lot of energy, and she's kind of nippy and barky, and mostly we've taken care of that, but when she wants attention, especially if I'm on the phone, she's often nipping and barking.
Yeah.
And not really sure what to do about that.
You know, my daughter, Emily, pulls on my leg and bites around on my knee when I'm on the phone.
Is she barking? Yes.
She doesn't bark, but she's cooing a little bit, you know, trying to get my attention.
Isn't it interesting how quickly animals learn when you've taken your attention away? You know, there's actually some research about wild animals being aware of the attention of another animal on them. Have you ever been in the woods, Larry, when all of a sudden you felt like you were being watched and you looked up and there was like a cuckoo or a squirrel or something just mm-hmm. right close and staring at you and you had this sense that you were being watched? The whole question of who's paying attention to who is really interesting. But in terms of what to do when your animal knows you've taken your attention off of them and they don't like it. There are a couple things to do, and you're in a great position with this new puppy. I don't know about Emily, Larry, but the new puppy is really young and very shapeable. So here's what I would do. I would just condition the puppy that when the phone rings, he's going to get or she's going to get a stuffed toy with food in it.
She loves that.
So you might even have your friends help you. So you ask some people to call you at 7, you know, o'clock, and so you're ready and you're prepared, and the phone rings, and what's your puppy's name?
Dee.
And so you say, Dee, sit, lie down, good puppy, okay, and then you give her the toy, and then she's lapping the food out from this hollow toy while you're talking on the phone.
That's great.
And that's great. And, you know, eventually she gets older. I want you to start weaning her so she's not like, yo, you, the phone rang, give me my toy. So you're not always going to do this. And she gets older, you might just say, honey, just go lie down and stay there for a little bit. And that's an okay thing to do, too.
Okay, that's really helpful.
Yeah, good luck.
Thanks a lot for calling. You know, I tell Emily to go lie down. And
do you give her a stuffed toy?
I don't give her a stuffed toy to lick on, though. And, you know, you were talking about this feeling of being watched. I was at my mother-in-law and father-in-law's home in their backyard, and I'm thinking, you know, something's not quite right. And so I look up in the tree. And here are 7 owls looking down on me. Screech owls, mom and dad, and 5 little ones, and they're all looking right at me.
Oh, how fun. And isn't that interesting that you had this sense?
You have this sense.
Isn't that interesting? We don't really quite understand how that works, but it's a very definite ability that we have.
And we know how a lot of things work, though.
And we'll know where you're going.
We'll talk more about them next week, won't we? We sure will. Patricia, thank you so much. Patricia McConnell is a PhD certified applied animal behaviorist and adjunct associate professor of zoology at the University of Wisconsin in Madison. And she's here every week to give you practical advice about your pet's behavior. Calling All Pets is produced by Wisconsin Public Radio. Our executive producer is Charles Monroe Kane. Our producer is Cynthia Schuster. Brad Kohlberg is our technical director. And Leo Sidran composed our theme music. I'm Larry Mueller with Patricia McConnell, hoping you'll join us again next time for more Calling All Pets.
Copies of today's show are available through the radio store at 800-747-7444. Ask for program number 0630P. More pet tips and advice for training new dogs or leaving pets home alone are available online at callingallpets.org. Our website also features a complete list of past guests and online archives of the program. The website, once again, is callingallpets.org.
On the next Calling All Pets, join us to discover whether dogs have the ability to imitate other dogs.
And we'll welcome 2 guests to tell us how crickets, cicadas, and other insects create all those amazing chirps and buzzes.
Tune in for that and more of your calls on the very next Calling All Pets.